Okay, so we are now come to the last session. This sutta is called the Malma Sutta. Malma was a cousin of the Buddha. He lived in Satyavatthu, in the Sakya Republic, where the Buddha himself originally came from. And the idea behind this sutta is all about how to give rise to joy and happiness in meditation practice. And you will see in the sutta how it is that meditation actually evolves and comes out of that joy and happiness that we give rise to. These are ways of actually lifting the mind up and making it happy so that the meditation can take off from that. So this topic is very interesting. It's a topic that you see in many places in the suttas, and it is a kind of standard way of using these techniques to give that joy in the meditation practice. So let's have a look and see what the Buddha has to say about this. So on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans at Kapilavatthu at the Banyan Tree Park. Then Mahanama, the Sakyan, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to the Blessed One, "Bhante, how does a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching often dwell?" Mahanama, a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching, often dwells in this way. So the first thing here is that this concerns a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit. It means somebody who is a stream enter. The point here is not that this is only applicable for stream enters, and if you're not the stream enter, you can't do it. The point is just that for the stream enter, this is natural. This happens as a matter of course. They often dwell in this way. Because for the stream enter, once you understand the Dhamma, it's like the joy that is connected with that is almost automatic, right? Because you know what it's all about. So, and that understanding, and understanding how beautiful it is and how powerful it is, that gives rise to a natural joy as a consequence. But this is also applicable to everyone else, and there are other suttas where it is addressed more to ordinary people and not just to those people who are various. So, let us see what the Buddha has to say about how one should often dwell. Here, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Tathagata thus. The Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly awakened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed trainer of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the awakened one, the blessed one. When a noble disciple recollects the Tathagata, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by greed, anger and delusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on the Tathagata. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, rapture arises. The one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. This is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population. Who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Buddha. So I'm sure you recognize some of these things. You probably recognize that sequence here. We talk about joy, and then joy from that comes rapture, tranquility, from tranquility, pleasure, and pleasure, samadhi, right? Stillness. That is exactly the same sequence that we saw at the very beginning, the very first sutta I read out of this retreat. Exactly the same sequence we're seeing there. And there it started off with sila, right? Sila led to all of these things. In this case, it starts off with recollection of the Buddha. So this case is more based on faith or confidence. In the other one, it's based more on your conduct, your virtue, and your sila. So this little paragraph here of how you recollect the Tathagata. The Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly enlightened, is the Bhagavan, Arahant, Samma, Sambuddha, Vijja, Charana, Sampanno, etc. Right? The standard recollection passage that we see in the suttas. So it's good to think a little bit about this and to understand what it actually refers to. Because once you understand what this refers to, and when you think about these qualities, they're obviously much more meaningful to you as a consequence. So the Blessed One is an Arahant, right? An Arahant is the height of spiritual perfection on the Buddhist path. It quite literally means the worthy one. One who is worthy of what? Well, he's worthy of anything really. He's worthy of listening to him because this is a person who has fully understood the teachings. But also worthy of generosity, worthy of all these kind of things. Because an Arahant, the whole point here is that they have something we want, right? They have access to these teachings. And of course, a teacher who teaches you something that you want is also worthy of something in return. That return is often much less than they can offer us anyway. But certainly a teacher like that is worthy of generosity and kindness, as it says further down in this one here. So the Arahant is a worthy one, the first worthy person. Perfectly enlightened, perfectly awakened, Samma, Sambuddha, right? The final awakening, the full understanding of the world, perfectly enlightened, awakened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, Vijja, Charana, Sampanno. And here the idea of true knowledge here, usually that is Vijja in the suttas is usually understood as the Te Vijja, the understanding, the recollection of past lives, understanding of the laws of Kamana, and also the final awakening. These are the Te Vijja. So accomplished in those three things, right? Accomplished in everything that is possible really in the Buddhist teachings. But the interesting thing here is that when you talk about the Buddha, it's not just that you are accomplished in true knowledge, you're also accomplished in conduct, right? It seems like conduct seems like a small thing compared to true knowledge. True knowledge seems like, wow, conduct, that sounds like something less. But the point here, I think the important point with this, is that if you really are awakened, if you really have seen something special, you have understood what the world is like, it leaves an impact on you. You are no longer the same person. You change according to that. If you give up all greed, hatred, and delusion, it means that the qualities that come out of you are going to be very pure, right? You're going to have a lot of metta, you're going to have a lot of time, you're going to have a lot of all these other good qualities. So your conduct actually changes. If you are truly awakened. And this is an important thing, because sometimes you may hear stories about crazy wisdom, right? And what this is saying is that there isn't really any such thing as crazy wisdom. If you are really wise, you're not crazy. If you're really wise, you are, your conduct also changes, and conduct and understanding go together. The way you act is the way you speak. The way you speak is the way you act. The Buddha says that specifically about himself and other places. Somebody who was awakened will act the part. They will have changed as a person. And this, of course, is very, very important, because what it means is that it is possible by observing somebody to have some idea of whether that person is really worthy of your confidence, right? If somebody has bad qualities, well, it probably means that there's some impurity inside, otherwise they wouldn't have those qualities probably. But if somebody is consistently pure and doing the right thing over a long period of time, that's usually a good sign that they also, there's something inside of them which is worthy of respect, something powerful going on there. So this is an important idea, that true insight, true understanding always goes together with conduct. You change, you become a different person as a consequence of this. So you're accomplished in these things, you have seen this fully, and you are, it says here, fortunate. Fortunate is sugato, it quite literally means somebody who has gone, well gone, in this case, it probably means somebody who's gone to a good destination, right? Arrived at a good place. Perhaps even just somebody who is really happy, right? This is what going to a good destination is about. It's about becoming happy, becoming content. Usually this word is sugati, it refers to the happy rebirth, but here obviously it refers to happiness in this very life. You have gone to the full destination, the right destination, which in this case is Nirvana. Sugato is of course a very important epithet of the Buddha. You hear it all the time. Sugato, Bhagava, etc. Knower of the world. So you know, what does that mean? Knower of the world. Well, on the one hand, it means something like knowing all the destinies, right? Understanding the path that leads to those destinations. In other words, the type of karma that takes you here or takes you there or whatever. Understanding the how samsara is structured, how it relates to your state of mind. It means all of these things, of course, understanding the world. But really, the important point here, the point that actually matters, why is it so important to understand about all these different realms and all that? Why do these things matter? And the only reason why it matters is because to be able to make a decision about what is right to do in this world, you have to understand about happiness and suffering, right? If you understand happiness and suffering fully, then you can act so that you can be happy and you can avoid suffering here. And the only way to fully understand happiness and suffering is to understand the whole potential. What is the potential for happiness and suffering? Not just in human life, but in any life. Anywhere, any rebirth. So when you say knower of the world, it's not so much about understanding rebirth, understanding galaxies or devas or whatever. It's understanding the scope of happiness and the scope of suffering in existence. Once you understand that, then you can make a decision about what you should be doing. Okay, so if samsara has some corner to it where you can be happy ever after, you go to that corner, right? Okay, happy ever after, that's good. Or if there is some sort of rebirth where you can kind of become permanently, stay permanent, okay, so maybe you go there. But you have to understand the whole thing, and then you can make a decision. Of course, the Buddha, he does understand. Whole point here that he does understand the whole scope of happiness and suffering, and that is when he can decide that actually there is no point in being reborn anymore. There's nowhere you can go where you will be forever contented. In fact, you will just continue to go round and round. But you can only make that decision once you understand things fully. Now, of course, you don't actually have to be reborn into all these places to understand this. Because you can understand these things through your own mind, right? Our mental states are really a reflection of samsara. You can feel, sometimes you feel like people say like sometimes they are like in a bit of a hell realm, right? They're really angry or something like that. And there is some truth to that, because when you are very angry or suffering a lot, it's almost like you are a little bit in a lower realm. Or sometimes you go into a very deep state of samadhi, it is equivalent to the state that you can experience on rebirth. So all of these things are actually inside of us. Because they are inside of us, you can access them just by looking inside. You don't have to actually experience the particular rebirths themselves. It's what sometimes they call the equivalence between personal state and the actual cosmos, or actual experiential, actual places of rebirth, if you like. So this is really what it means to know the world. It means to understand happiness and suffering in its completeness, right? Only then can you really be a teacher, because to explain happiness and suffering fully. Otherwise, you don't know what you're talking about. Unsurpassed trainer of persons to be tamed. Anuttaro buddhisadhamma sarathin. To be tamed, I would say tameable, unsurpassed training of tameable people. So I like that, tameable people, right? Are you tameable? Are you wild or are you tameable? That's the question. So it is true that the whole point here is that it takes certain people are interested in Dhamma, some are not, right? And if you have no interest and you are not inclining towards this, and you are already committed to your personal God or whatever it is, sometimes it is just you can't do anything for some people. They're not going to come this way. writer. But sometimes you are not quite literally not tenable because of your views, because of your standpoints, maybe because you are very, you know, maybe whatever it is, whatever the reason is, you may not be actually tameable. So a tameable person is someone, at the very least, you have to have an interest in the Dhamma. Then there'll be some chance that we might tame you, right? So I like that. Kind of, it is a certain wildness about the mind that is always driven this way by craving, by ill will, by restlessness, by agitation, right? The mind is kind of wild, moving around like this all the time. I'm sure you know what I mean. The Tang mind is the one that is peaceful, that isn't driven around by craving, but it's always peaceful, you're always relaxed, always at ease, right? So again?
Tranquil,
exactly, yeah? So all of these beautiful words that actually describe what that kind of mind is like. Yeah. So tameable. So if you are tameable, then the Buddha becomes your unsurpassed teacher, unsurpassed trainer. If not, he is not. Why is he unsurpassed? Well, the reason he is unsurpassed is precisely because he is the knower of the world. He understands happiness and suffering to its fullest extent, right? He understands that everybody is looking for this. Everybody is looking for solutions to ending problems and suffering and finding true happiness. This is one reason why he's unsurpassed. The second reason why he's unsurpassed is because he has compassion, precisely because he knows that he has the answer to the problem everybody wants to solve. If you have the answer to that, you want to share it with the people, you want to say, listen, I have the answer. So compassion arises in him when he understands that he has the answer to all of this. So this is sort of compassion together with insight, together with understanding, is a very powerful combination there. And the third thing which makes the Buddha special is that he has no vested interest, right? If you listen to him or not, he will probably shrug his shoulders and say, okay, it's your problem. You know, here I am, I'm giving you this beautiful, profound teaching that will help you. If you are not interested, well, really, it's your problem. I'm happy already. I don't, you know, whether you listen or not going to make any difference to me, right? And this is very beautiful. If somebody has no vested interest, if they have no ego they want to gratify, if they have no personal gain in this at all, it means the teaching is so pure. It's very, very pure. Most people, you know, that when they teach the Dhamma, but some people teach the Dhamma, they think, oh, what can I get out of this, right? See this over here? This is what you get out of teaching the Dhamma, right? You come here and you think, oh, you know. So you have to be careful, because if you think like that, if you have a vested interest, that purity isn't there anymore, right? That purity isn't there, and then you lose something because of that. But the Buddha, absolutely pure, the Buddha doesn't care if you give a donation or not. The Buddha doesn't care if you say sadhu at the end of the talk. It doesn't care if you just walk off in the middle of the talk. And this is why it becomes so pure. It means that you can trust the Buddha 100%. Because all he wants to do is to be compassionate, and all he's coming from is this profound understanding. These are some of the reasons why he's so unsurpassed, right? And also, obviously, he was very wise. I mean, here is somebody who is capable of finding their way through samsara, finding the highest happiness all by themselves without another teacher. It takes somebody very special to do that. Anyway, so that's the unsurpassed trainer or teacher of tameable people. He is teacher of devas and humans. Sometimes people think that the devas are really cool, right? Imagine, there's one little sutta which is quite nice. The sutta is the Sakka, you know, the god of Kavahingsa heaven, the kind of the leader of Kavahingsa heaven, comes down to the Buddha and asks the Buddha a question. And the Buddha says, first of all, well, have you asked this question before other people? And Sakka, yes, I have. I went to these other teachers. And they are these kind of standard teachers in the human realm. You have Digantha Nandaputta, Purana Kassapa, Makkaligosara. These are all the kind of leaders of their sects in India at that time. And Sakka, I went to these teachers, right? But when I went to them, they started bowing down to me. Because they saw, you know, all these teachers, they see this light, right? This incredibly powerful being. Imagine a deva coming down, right? the Deva tries to ask you a question, but then instead of actually the Deva having a chance to ask, all the monks are bowing down to this Deva because the Lord God had arrived, right? So this is the problem. This is the problem in life, is that sometimes when we see something very powerful, we're so awe-inspired, right? Whoa, why don't we check it out? This is too much. Imagine if some very powerful light being came down on earth in front of you. Well, how would you react? you would be taken aback, right? You would really be, whoa, this is, you know. And the point here, so the point of this is that the Buddha doesn't react like that. Because the Buddha understands that just because you happen to be a light being, just because you have certain powers that other beings don't have, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have the same wisdom. These beings arise because of karma in this way. They've done something good in the past life. It's not because they have any profound wisdom necessarily. So when the Sakya goes to the Buddha teaches him the Dhamma, and then he's very happy as a consequence. I'm not sure how much these sutras should be taken as legends or absolute truth or whatever, but I think the message still is very important. The message still remains the same. So Buddha is teachers of gods and humans. So we don't kind of, it is not these displays of power that are the most important thing. It's the wisdom in your heart that really matters. And that is what the Buddha, of course, has more than anybody else. So this is an important point here, and of course it's also something that is important in the context of Indian culture at the time. In the culture they would always be, you know, talking about gods and Brahmas and all these kind of things. But here the Buddha is saying, well actually, you know, all these gods, they're actually not, you know, they don't have as much wisdom as I have. I'm actually above all of these gods, right? And that's why sometimes you see in the suttas, you see Brahma coming down, bowing to the Buddha, and all of these kind of things. The idea is that the Buddha actually has more understanding. And it's important from a Buddhist point of view to get that point across, so that people don't get confused about this. Okay. Then the awakened one and the blessed one. The blessed one is the Bhagavan. It's almost like the Lord. In India today, if you are like a spiritual leader, sometimes you call yourself Bhagavan, right? Even though you are this really dodgy character, like rising and all kind of dodgy stuff, still you call yourself Bhagavan. The famous Indian teacher, Osho, Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh. You may have heard of him. He's now basically been completely. He did lots of things that were really, really bad, but he called himself Bhagavan at the height of his fame. So, like Lord or whatever. Anyway, so this is the power of the Buddha, right? The Buddha has this beautiful combination of compassion and wisdom, two things going together very beautifully. When he's talking to you, and that is what he's doing when you're reading the suttas, he's talking to you directly. Remember that, right? You read the word of the Buddha, it's the Buddha talking to you. It's a very powerful thought. But when he's talking to you, he's doing so out of compassion and out of wisdom. Only because he wants you to be happy. Only because he wants to help you out of his problems. So when you read the suttas, remember the Buddha is talking to you. And I don't mean this in a figurative sense, I mean it in a very literal sense. Because the Buddha, when he laid down his teachings, he knew that the Dhamma would pass a long time into the future. He knew that there were people sitting around the world listening to the Dhamma, reading his teachings, right? And this is one of the reasons, I think, why he laid it down in a language which tends to be very universal, very, very applicable. It doesn't matter which time and history you're at, it doesn't matter which culture you go to, it's applicable to anybody, right? You read it today, you can relate to it, just like if you relate to it in India 2,500 years ago. So he knew this teaching is going to last into the future. There will be people sitting at the Buddhist Fellowship, at the BGF Center, on, what is it, the 17th of April or whatever, on the 17th of April 2016, and they will be listening to these things. So he is speaking to each one of us very, very directly. So remember that when you read the suttas, it's the Buddha talking to you. It's a very powerful thought, will you understand that? So we are disciples of the Buddha, just like they were at that time. So feel that, the Buddha, when you feel that you're not just reading a text, but actually the Buddha is speaking to you, it becomes so much more powerful then. And then remember, these words are said with compassion, with wisdom, there's no vested interest. Everything which is there is only for your benefit, right? So if you see something that you find hard to understand or whatever in there, don't be too quick to reject it. It is there basically to help us. And if you can't deal with it, fine, just put it to one side for now. But remember to come back to it later on when you are ready. Because there may be one day when you can take that on board and it can become something very useful in the practice. So these are the kind of, when you reflect about the Dhamma in this way, it becomes far more powerful for you and far more useful. So that is the recollection of the Buddha. And when you do recall the Buddha in that way, then sometimes what happens is that because of that, your mind on that occasion is not obsessed by the hindrances, right? By greed, hatred and delusion, raga, dosa and moha or something like that. Yeah. Your mind is free of those things. Why? Because you are focusing on something that is completely wholesome. Your mind is going in a different direction. Your mind is taking the path of the Dhamma. You are understanding what the Dhamma is about, and you are not really these other things kind of get banished as a consequence. And on that occasion, your mind is simply straight, based on the Tathagata. Ujju, your mind is Ujju. Ujju is straight in the Pali. And the defilements are said to be what makes the mind crooked. Right? The mind is crooked, the mind is distorted, the mind is bent because of the defilements. You can't see straight. Here the mind is straight. Your view is approximating the view of the Buddha, and things are going in the right way. The noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning. This is the Anta, gains inspiration in the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the doctrine, is the teaching. The Anta is the goal of that teaching. Right? So not only do you understand the Dhamma, you're hearing the Dhamma, but at the same time you understand why this Dhamma is so important. You understand where it is heading. Where is it heading? It is heading towards more happiness, more contentment, more compassion, more understanding. It's heading away from the problems and defilements and the problems of the world and the suffering of the world. Once you understand that, you understand that here is the answer to everything you have ever desired in your whole life. That's what you understand. Right? If you have found the answer to everything in life, everything you could ever want, that is why you get inspired, right? You feel, wow, this is it. What a wonderful thing, and this inspiration. The Pali term is Veda, and Veda means like a mixture of feeling and understanding. Veda is related to the English word wit. These are Indo-European languages, all these languages are related. The English word wit, somebody who has ready wit means somebody who is kind of sharp-witted. Same meaning in the Indian language, related to Vicha, which means understanding. It means you understand what's going on, but also you feel what's going on. Veda also has to do with feeling, right? Because your understanding is based on reality, or based on what is actually there, based on the truth, so to speak, you feel a powerful feeling as a consequence. So this is why Bhikkhu Bodhi translates this as inspiration, because inspiration is a bit like that. It's feeling combined with understanding. When you have feeling combined with understanding, you're starting to see the Dhamma, you understand what it's all about, and you get in, as it says here, inspiration in the meaning, the Atta Veda, the Dhamma Veda, the joy connected with the Dhamma, the joy arises from this, right? You understand where it's all headed, you understand how powerful it is, you understand that this is everything that you could ever want in your life is actually connected, actually right here. And then, from that, right, now you have kind of laid the groundwork, you have given rise to joy in the mind, then all you have to do is sit back and wait for this sequence of factors to arise. Now you can either continue to reflect on the Buddha if it is working for you, or now you can also, if you want, combine that with watching the breath or whatever. And then this whole sequence that we were talking about before arises out of this. When you have joyful, rapture arises, the piti, the physical and mental pleasure, the rapturous mind, you get tranquil, right? You go deeper and deeper in your meditation. From tranquility, you feel pleasure, the powerful sukha. And then, because of that, your mind is still. You gain samadhi. And then, of course, when you gain samadhi, the mind is where you want it to be able to either just to enjoy the samadhi or to take it further to gain even more profound insight than you have already had. So this is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population. Your mind is in balance, right? It's not being driven this way and that way by desires and craving. You are kind of at ease. Your mind is steady. And you are dwelt unafflicted in an afflicted population. Craving, ill will, all of these problems, they are afflictions of the mind. They are suffering. They are problems. But you are now moving beyond that. And as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Buddha. So, that is just a little bit about how to think about the Buddha, to understand why the Buddha is so important and how powerful all of this is. And once you get into that, you can give rise to these kind of feelings as a consequence. Everybody happy with that? Yeah? Okay. Good. So, let us move on to the next one then. The other ones will be much quicker because now we have kind of gone through the main part already. Again, Mahalama, a noble disciple, recollects the Dhamma thus. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise. When a noble disciple recollects the Dhamma, on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by greed, ill will, and delusion. On that occasion, his mind is simply straight, based on the Dhamma. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gets inspiration in the meaning, gets inspiration in the Dhamma, gets joy connected with the Dhamma. When his joyful rapture rises, for one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. For one tranquil in body, feels pleasure. One feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. This is called the noble disciple, who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population. Who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population, and one as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Dhamma. The same thing again, but now we have the recollection of the Dhamma. Svāgato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko, etc. So the first thing here, which is interesting, is the idea that the Dhamma is well expounded by the Buddha. What exactly does that mean? And what it obviously means a number of things, but one of the things that I think it means is that when the Buddha taught his teachings, he would have been very careful in the way he taught his teachings. I think, did I mention this before? Maybe I did. I can't remember now. And the reason for that is because. The reason why the Buddha would have been very careful is that when he taught the Dhamma, I think I've mentioned this before, but anyway, I'll say it again, he knew that because it's an oral tradition, whatever he says, you cannot really change it afterwards, right? 100 people listening to you, you're giving out the teachings, and then it will have to be carried on like that into the future. So once something is kind of spoken and said, it is really there. So he would have been very careful to express himself in the right way from the beginning. And for that reason, and he also said that much in other places as well, for that reason, when you read the word of the Buddha, you can be fairly certain that everything has a very clear meaning and a very obvious meaning. Everything is said with a certain purpose. He doesn't really mince his words, doesn't add anything unnecessarily. It is all there for a reason. But also, kind of gives you, makes you read more carefully, right? It makes you take on board every word with greater care when you understand that this is very likely to have been in the Buddha's mind when he taught this thing. So it is well expounded, it's directly visible, sandhittiko. Sandhittiko is used in the suttas as the opposite of samparvayika. Samparvayika means that which relates to the future life. Sandhittika means it relates to this life. The Dhamma is about this life. You can attain everything in the Dhamma right here in this very life. You don't have to wait until after you're dead to find out if you're right or not, right? And sometimes that's too late, right? And, oh, I was wrong, okay, then it's really tough luck after you. After you're dead. So this is the nice thing about the Dhamma. It is you can get it right here in this life. Don't have to wait after you're dead. Sandhittika. Akalika, similar kind of idea. It doesn't have to do with time. Kala is time, Akali. Akalika, not to do with time. Like timeless or immediate or don't have to wait to the future life to see if it is true. Inviting one to come and see. Again, the same kind of idea, right? Says, well, here are the teachings. Do the practice and see what happens. And if it works, you will get more confidence. You will get more faith. If it doesn't work, what do we say if it doesn't work? We don't, okay, then you don't have to be a Buddhist. No, we don't say that. If it doesn't work, we say, you're not practicing the right way. So yeah, it's like a get out of jail free card, right? Regardless of what people say, you have some kind of excuse for that. But of course, if it really doesn't work, people will tend to lose faith. That's the reality of it. So you have to teach the teaching properly, give people a chance to try it out, and then if it works, then faith will improve. If it doesn't work, even if it is their fault or whatever it is, still faith will tend to disappear. So it's always a good thing when you practice and it has good results. It's always very, you feel very good. This is one of the things that has kept me in monastic life for so long, because it is so obvious that it gives results as you keep on going. Applicable, the Pali word here is opanarika, and it means something like leading onwards. As you practice, as you apply yourself to the teaching, it actually takes you along. You're following along at every stage of the path, but you gain some kind of insight, understanding, happiness, reduction and suffering. Remember at the very at the beginning of the gradual training, the Buddha says that the teaching, the Dhamma, is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, right? This is a similar kind of thing as you have here, the idea of opanarika, leaning onwards. Regardless of where you are at in the training, it has beneficial results. And this is one of the things I would recommend you to think about when you do your practice. Is it giving you results? Are you getting somewhere, right? From 1 year to the next one, do you find that you are improving in mindfulness? Do you feel more kind-hearted, soft-hearted towards the people around you? Do you feel that some of your negative traits are kind of becoming less? Are you becoming less upset about things around you, right? All these kind of things. So you look at that, and a good way of finding that out is to occasionally go on a meditation retreat and see how your meditation is going. Then often you find out whether you are improving or not. And it's important to be honest about that, because every stage of the path, there's a natural benefit to be had if you do it in the right way. And if you're not getting those benefits, you're missing out, right? You don't want to miss out, you want to get all the benefits, of course. So you have to ask yourself, why is it? What is holding you back? One of the things about the Buddhist path is this sense we have to be honest with ourselves. If you're not honest with yourself, only you are going to lose out as a consequence, because you won't be making that progress. So opanarika, this beautiful idea that every time as you move along the path, every time you move along, there is more happiness and less suffering to be had. Right? Every step of the way is kind of better. And after a while you think, wow, this is pretty good already. I wonder where all this is going, right? If it's so good already, geez, it must be really nice when I get to the next stage. And you keep on going, it's like up and up and up and up. And you know, you have kind of, it gets very exciting after a while. And then you see people who have practiced the path for a long time, and you see what they are like, and you can see that very often the path has results. This is one of the things that I always felt, one of the reasons why I came to Australia, because I wasn't in Australia before now. I came to Australia just to ordain, actually, to become a monk. And one of the reasons I came there, and it was because I felt that in the, with Ajahn Brahm, I felt that there is something here which is authentic. There is a real experience of Dhamma, right? You get inspired when you see the Dhamma is practiced and you see the result at the same time. This is what kind of inspires you. So you see that in yourself, but in the meantime, you also see it in some of the people around you. You also see the same kind of thing. Upanayaka, leading onwards. And last one, to be personally experienced by the wise. So that is, you've got to be wise, right? we all have the capacity to be wise. Wise does not mean intelligent. So we all have that capacity. So it's just a matter of doing the right thing, and then you will get there as a consequence. So, this is this Dhamma, and of course, again, the important point here, and the thing which is so profound about this, is that the Dhamma, when you practice it in the right way, it gives you access to all of those things that you ever wanted in your life. Everything is there on the planet, right? This, of course, is very, very, very powerful. And once you understand that, of course, you feel inspired as a consequence, and you feel a sense of joy, and then all of these things happen again, just like before. Okay, the Sangha. Again, Mahanama, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, one after the other. Again, Mahanama, the noble disciple recollects the Sangha thus. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, the straight way, the true way, practicing the proper way. That is the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of the merit for the world. And when you recollect that, all of the things happen just like before. Your mind is straight and you gain samadhi eventually on the basis of that. So, here you see basically all of these qualities. Here again, they're practicing the straight way because they understand what the way is, right? These are the people who have understood the path, and they are worthy of all these particular qualities. Sometimes it's difficult to know who the Aryans are, who are the noble people in the Sangha. It's very hard to know because sometimes people can seem very impressive, but they can still be ordinary people underneath. It's very hard to actually be sure about this. But generally speaking, you can see that sometimes there are people who practice in such a way that is very inspiring and very impressive. And sometimes when I hear a story about some of these monks, some of the nuns as well, let me think. What was that? Anyway, some of the stories are very, very nice and inspiring. And in particular, I remember always there is stories of the monks who live in the forest, right? And they live in the forest by themselves for years and years, sometimes decades on end. And it's astonishing. Some of the way that this is from this just happens to be from Sri Lanka. And in Sri Lanka, there's a lot of forest land, and the jungle can be very large. And very often, there will be some of these monks that have like a kuti in the middle of the jungle. And a few kilometers away will be a small village, right? And every day, he will walk into the village, get his alms, and then return back to his kuti in the forest. And apart from that, he will see nobody, absolutely nobody, except for this one trip in to the village once a day, and then go back again to eat. And these kutis that they have are, especially this one monk who has this kutis that he has built, he only has three walls. Right? This is in the jungle, right? If you have three walls in the jungle, that's quite interesting. So he says that sometimes when he wakes up in the morning, there's like a snake there sitting next to him, right? Because the snake has gone to sleep next to him. He wakes up in the morning, oh, good morning, snake, or whatever. And this is how you live for decade after decade, year after year, in the forest by yourself, just surrounded by wild animals. Right? It's very, very, very simple, no luxuries, nothing at all, very, very simple life. And when you hear that, you think that it becomes very clear that The only way you can do that in the long run is if you have access to some kind of happiness, something that ordinary people do not have access to. Most people in the tribe, you would go crazy. And if you didn't go crazy, you'd be killed by a snake, right? So you have to have some metta or something special to be able to actually survive that kind of situation and to be able to live. You have access to a different type of happiness. And this is already often enough to be inspired, right? And there are many monks like that. There's another monk who comes to mind as well. And he said that when he was walking around Sri Lanka for about 35 years, never stopping in one place except for the rains retreat, and he would just find good places to meditate and stay there for a while and then move on. And one day he was walking down a certain road and a disciple of his saw him, and he was walking towards this junction, right? It was a few meters away, it was this junction, he had to go either right or left. So, and his disciple wanted to give him something, so he asked, "Oh, Bhante, when you come to the junction just over there, are you going to go left or are you going to go right?" And he says, "I don't know, I'll decide when I get there." Right? So you are completely in the present moment. You have no idea where you're going. And when you get to the junction right there, then you say, left, right, okay, right, or left, or whatever. So this is kind of how some of these monks would live. And it's very inspiring when you hear the stories. Or you have like Ajahn Brahm staying in his cave or staying in the studio for 6 months. He didn't speak to a single person. He didn't even go into the village, right? He didn't speak to one person for 6 months. And again, most people, they go crazy in that kind of situation. After a while, you've got to talk to somebody. Desperate to talk to somebody. And of course, he does that. And when he comes out afterwards, he says, 6 months of bliss. Right? 6 months of bliss. Because all he had was a small cutie, 7 square meters, and a walking path outside. And he stayed in that cutie, on that walking path, without fail, for 6 months. Imagine that, right? Complete, almost like complete sensory deprivation. The only thing he had was a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya, and he would occasionally read the Sutta and the Majjhima Nikaya, just like we're doing here now. That's all he ever did for 6 months. That and meditation practice. And again, you understand that when people do this kind of thing, there is something inside of them. They have some access to a certain happiness, to a certain reality, a certain understanding that is beyond what most people have. And this can give you a sense of faith and confidence that there's something going on. Or sometimes it isn't true, sometimes it may just be somebody who endures or whatever, but sometimes it is also the real thing. And certainly for me, I find it quite inspiring when I hear some of these stories. I think there wasn't there some... Anyway, I thought there was some other story I wanted to tell, but I can't, it's not coming up right now, so... Okay, so this is the Sangha, right? You have some idea whether people are practicing the right way. One of the very interesting things that you find in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which always struck me as very important, very interesting, is that in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha, this is the last sutta talking about the Buddha, just as he's about to die, right? Of course, the Buddha knows that he is on his way to die. And because he knows that, this is now when he lays down his legacy. He gives the final instructions to the Sangha, telling them about how they should continue the teaching after he has passed away. And one of the things he talks about in there is the 7 ways of protecting Buddhism, protecting the Dhamma for the future. Right? So 7 things are things like you should meet often, you should meet with harmony, and these kind of things that you might expect. But one of those 7 things that will enable the prosperity of the Dhamma and Buddhism in the future is as long as the Sangha, as long as the monastics live in the forest and enjoy forest dwellings, for that long, Buddhism will be strong, the Dhamma will be strong, and the Dhamma will flourish in the world. And this is powerful because it shows sometimes, I mean, we all probably know that living in the forest, withdrawing from the world is an important aspect of meditation practice. It kind of makes sense. But actually, it's not just important, it's so important that the future of Buddhism actually depends on it. That's what the Buddha says. That is how important it is. So it's really, really important. Why is it so important? Well, precisely for the reasons I said before. It is in the formalist, when you're withdrawn from ordinary society, withdrawn from the hustle and bustle of life, and withdrawn from the standard kind of sensory impingement, it is then that it's possible to gain that samadhi usually, gain those insights that will enable you to uphold Buddhism in the future. Buddhism will only continue as long as people are accessing that truth of samadhi, but especially the truth of insight that the Buddha taught. As long as people are accessing those things, having the same insight as the Buddha had, only then will Buddhism be supported again, also into the future. So I was surprised when I saw that, because I think it is true to say that there are of course many monastics who live in the city and live in the village or whatever, who do an important job, and I don't want to kind of put them down or anything like that. But that thing which ultimately will uphold Buddhism is when people withdraw from society completely to enable them to access the same insight that Buddha accessed it. Okay, so we have run out of time pretty much. That's okay. I will just very briefly just mention the last two recollections. The last two recollections is a recollection of your sila, your virtuous behavior, your kindness, your good heart. And the very last one is the recollection of generosity, right? So, and you don't really have to work very hard to recollect these things. If you do the right thing, if you live a good life, if you are kind and generous, normally when you sit down, you just get that, it comes back to you anyway, just like a mountain that you have built for yourself of good actions. All of these things come down, and come back to you when you sit down peacefully here. That is really, in the end, what that recollection is about. And then you gain the happiness, and you gain all the things, samadhi, all the other things in this list, as a consequence of that. So, you can read that for yourself, and next when I come, maybe if I come back next year, then maybe we can have more time to look at those things, because they actually are very inspiring as well. Okay, so now let us have a tea break, and then we can do the final session Q&A in half an hour, in about quarter to five. Yes, okay.
Sorry.